12 o'clock. You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time once again for another exciting edition of the Lunch Special.
Welcome to another edition of the Lunch Special. And when political, economic, and religious leaders no longer offer any solutions to the massive crisis that confront us, it's time to reimagine who we are as individuals and as a nation. Madness at the Gates of the City, the Myth of American Innocence, shows how America regularly reenacts old patterns that cause us to subvert our goals, miss the deeper meaning in events, and perhaps fail to prevent our headlong slide into cultural collapse. But by looking at our history, politics, and popular culture through the lens lenses of Greek mythology, indigenous wisdom, and archetypal psychology, Barry Spector discovers new hope in very old ways of thinking. That was written by Robert A. Johnson, who did the foreword to this book, Madness at the Gates of the City, and whose author, Barry, the myth of American innocence, whose author is here in the studio with us, Barry Spector. Barry, welcome to KZSU's Lunch Special.
Thank you for having me here. It's great to be in your building under the very shadow of Hoover Tower.
Mordor.
Thank you so much. It's good to have you here. Please tell us how you came up with the title.
I was taking a series of wonderful extended learning classes, night classes here at Stanford about 10, 12 years ago with one of your great teachers, Marsh McCall, the classicist. And I was fortunate enough to be be studying one of the great tragic dramas, the Bacchae by Euripides, which was written about 400 A.D. B.C. I'm sorry, and I was fortunate enough to see that that these old stories, these old mythic stories, are not just dinosaurs of literature for us to study, but they actually have a lot of relevance to who we are. And so I began to write specifically about that story, and I was seeing parallels to who we are as modern Americans. So Madness at the Gates of the City, that kind of refers to this mythic image of the god Dionysus, who in the story comes to the city and of Thebes, and causes the demise of the king, who has been a kind of a puritanical macho character. And Dionysus is the god in Greek myth of alcohol and intoxication, but he's also the god of madness, and he's the god, if you look at him more deeply, he's the god of spiritual ecstasy. And what I saw in reading the Bacchae was an archetypal image that is in the human soul. It's not just something from 2,400 years ago. It's in all of us, which is to say, if you look at the writers, the academics who write about Greek myth, every single one of them has a different idea of what this figure Dionysus is.
Exactly. You said even René Girard, he was of the French Academy. He says Dionysus is one thing, another academic says another thing. Yeah. And I like the way you portrayed his role as a figure that is, I mean, it's a different perspective, and that was in your book, which was very interesting. Yeah. And in your opinion, what is myth for our audience
just to hear a little bit before we move on to that question? What I saw in the figure of Dionysus that I want to bring in early on here was another way of looking at him. I see him as a mythic image that conveys to us this archetypal figure of the other. And to me, what the other represents is a part of ourselves, of who we are at our very core, but for various reasons we can't accept, we can't acknowledge. And so what we do throughout history and culture is since we can't accept aspects of ourselves, we project the other upon convenient scapegoats. And of course that gets us back to Girard, who writes about scapegoating. I think it's something that's been a common theme in Western culture from the very beginning. But when we get into talking about the specific stories of American culture, we'll see how we project the other in America, both on our internal scapegoats and also our external scapegoats.
And how does that relate to today? Could you bring up a couple of examples that come to mind to illustrate this?
Okay, well, you know, we're going to circle around here between history, psychology, mythology, and even popular culture.
And this is your book. This is what your book ties in. Yeah. It ties everything, all these concepts together.
Well, I think for 400 years, due to our incredibly deep and still very powerful Puritan heritage, Americans in particular have been projecting this otherness. And in the American stories, the other is that aspect of ourselves that cannot
be. So then they imagine or.
Well, I'm trying to reach something here.
We're here with the author, Barry Spector. He's the author of the book Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence.
It's about self-control. What our Puritan heritage left in us is a deep, strong sense of self-control. And so what we have projected upon others is this inability to control our own impulses. So early on, we saw the Native Americans, who lived lives of that the European colonizers could not understand or tolerate, and so they projected this otherness upon the Native Americans, and then later on, as we brought African slaves in here, they projected this otherness upon African Americans. And for 400 years in particular, the regular scapegoat that we come back to when we need to distract ourselves is race, and so our internal other, so to speak, has been first the Native Americans and then the African Americans.
And how would you illustrate this in mythology? And in your book, it's packed with amazing examples. And would you please offer some thoughts about how this how did you translate this to mythology? Some of these concepts.
Well, let me get back to one of your first questions. You asked me what is myth. So let's say a couple of things about myth. They may or may not be literally true. They are the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. And I say that because the academics will go to incredible lengths to define what myth is. But I think it's too important to get get stuck in academic jargon. To me, it's very simple. Myths are stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. They speak to our unresolved conflicts, needs, and fantasies. They give us meaning, and they tell us who we are. In indigenous cultures with functioning mythologies, myths and the rituals associated with them rooted everyone in the recurrent cycles of nature, initiated their children, and connected them to the deep mysteries of existence. In such societies, myth and ritual enable the elders to recognize and welcome the innate purpose of each individual. So I would say that in classical Greece, approximately 400 BC, this was already a culture that was in which the mythology was breaking down. And when Euripides wrote this tale of the Bacchae, it was actually a very old tale. He was describing, in a sense, the breakdown of myth, because he was implying that that the elite forces in the culture were more interested in power and empire than in a sustainable culture, which is not a term they would have used then, but it's a term that is increasingly important to us now. In some parts of the world, we still have a few a few vestiges of cultures that are, that's mythologies and rituals that still work. I call this the creative imagination. In places like in certain parts of Africa and Central America, and for example in Bali in Asia, there are still areas where you can find stories and mythologies and the rituals, as I said, associated with them that that give people meaning and allow the innate essence of each individual to be recognized by the people in these cultures.
We're speaking with the author Barry Spector, author of Manus at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. You can find this from Regent Press from Berkeley. Their website is www.regentpress.net. And Barry Spector, we're going to go to a musical break. Would you like to introduce this song?
Which one is it?
Number two.
Okay, and we're going to take a listen. We'll be right back with the author, Barry Spector, here on KZSU's Lunch Special.
Thank you.
We're here on KZSU's Lunch Special with the Barry Spector, author of the book Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence from Regent Press. And Barry, who was that?
I can't tell you exactly who they are, but what it is it's an ancient song from Zimbabwe, and it's a welcoming song. And as I understand it, it's one of the songs, kind of part of the ritual that happens in the old initiation practices, which in some parts of Africa are still, we still have vestiges of. And that leads me to, I want to say a couple words about this question of initiation, because
this
it's
is my favorite part.
Because it's connected, it's very much connected to mythology, and we'll see, it's connected to the American story as well. Joseph Campbell's great book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, laid out a basic story that he saw in cultures all across the world. He saw it everywhere. He called it the monomyth. And in the monomyth, it's a very simple story, although it's repeated in countless variations and in hero stories all across the world. Usually it's a young man. He hears a call. He's part of a community, but he hears a call and he ventures forth out into the unknown. And he may do battle with dragons or have to, voyage across terrible spaces and such. Eventually, he may meet the beautiful maiden, but he achieves his quest and he returns to his community. So there are three parts to the story: the hearing of the call, the struggle in the unknown space, and the return to the community. Now, what some of us have discovered, and Campbell himself mentioned, is that this three-part sequence that you see in all of these hero myths exactly replicates the ritual steps in initiation, where young people are first called out of community, subjected to great ordeals, which may or may not actually be life-threatening ordeals. They're certainly soul-threatening ordeals, and ordeals that bring the soul and the essence out of them. And this is the important part. They are welcomed back into community. That's the third part. So the ritual sequence replicates the three-part hero myth. And so this bit of music that we had, it doesn't even have a title. It's just a welcoming song. So you can imagine when the young men have been taken out into the bush for maybe 6 weeks and nobody knows what's happening to them or if they're going to come back. But when they do come back, the entire village would welcome them back with a song like that, acknowledging that they are now no longer children. They're men.
Exactly, and it's a growth process.
Yeah, and it's one of the fundamental. Things, of course, that we lack in modern culture. And to my mind, this creative imagination that I mentioned a little while ago has been almost entirely lost in modern culture. And what we have instead are two kinds of imaginations that I have labeled the predatory imagination, which is the desire for conquest and just an absolute unquenchable desire for more and more, which expresses itself in colonialism and war and all the worst aspects of our lives, and also the other way we seem to live is through the paranoid imagination. So I see modern people expressing either the paranoid imagination or the predatory imagination. With the paranoid imagination, it's characterized by just a constant state of fear. Fear of change, and I think it expresses primarily through fundamentalist religion in this culture. Or another polarity would be fundamentalist religion on the one hand, expressing this paranoid imagination, and modern consumer culture, which would be another expression of the predatory imagination. So this is what we have. This is the state that we're in. This is our state of alienation. It's common now to talk about the culture collapsing, but the culture has been collapsing for a long time because individuals in the culture have been forgetting who we are. And there were many theories of alienation, but to indigenous people, to tribal people who still live in this creative imagination, it's very simple. They look at us and they say, we just don't know who we are as modern people. And the reason is because we don't have these initiation rituals anymore. So,
it ties in with the other, Dionysus, in your book.
And you wanted to ask me about Letima, didn't you?
Letima, yes, I would.
Did you want to read that, or should I just mention it?
I would love for you to expound on that. And it has to do with ritual and going out.
Yeah, there's growing. There's a concept from East Africa. It's called Letima, L-I-T-I-M-A. I believe it's from the Gisu people in Uganda. And this concept implies that it describes all of the worst things that we think of when we think of masculinity, the aggressiveness and the struggle for competition just all the crazy things that adolescent young men do in the world. But, and here's the interesting part, it is also the source of our deepest creativity and of our essence. And so what these people do in their initiation rituals is they try to bring out this Letima in young men and channel it in creative ways through the initiation process. And this is what, again, this is what a major aspect of what we don't have anymore in modern culture. And because we don't have initiation in modern culture, we have what some people would call the toxic mimic of initiation. We have young men riding motorcycles and pushing the envelope of physical danger. We have tens of millions of young men going off to war, trying to find out what it is to be masculine in this culture. And since we have so few areas, so few elders who are willing to
guide
young people, and I'm speaking mostly about men, but young women have the same issue. With women, it's not quite the same. I would say the most common area where you see young women expressing these issues is in early pregnancy. In a sense, they take the world in an inappropriate way, and when they're not ready, and you have children having more children. With young men, however, it's a much more serious issue because men go off to war. The elites in our culture could never have another war if there weren't millions of young men who are so desperate to figure out who they are in some way, and to figure out who they are as masculine beings. So this is the state we're in as modern people. But I really want to get into our American stories as well. Did you have another question you wanted to throw out there?
I just want to say to the audience, we are speaking with Barry Spector, author of Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence, and you can find this from Regent Press from Berkeley, and their website is www.regentpress.net. And also, I remember...
Or Amazon,
too. There you go. And you also, I remember, you're talking in your book. Your book talks about Dionysus tying in to this myth about we are living on the backs of the children, like the destruction of children. So
it's interesting. I was going to tell a couple of poems. Maybe I'll throw them in now. If I forgot, I was going to do them earlier. Two quick poems. The first one is from about 2700 B.C. It's from what's called the Homeric Hymn to Dionysus. It says, "Be good to us, you girl-crazy goat. We the poets begin and end our singing through you, and it's impossible without you. Without remembering you, we cannot remember our sacred songs. And I want to tell you another poem. This one was written in the trenches of northern France in 1918 by Wilfred Owen. It's called The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. So Abram rose and clave the wood and took with him fire and a knife. And as they sojourned, the two of them together, Isaac, the firstborn, spake and said, "Behold, father, the preparations, fire and iron. But where the lamb for this burnt offering?" And Abram bound the youth with belts and cords and took with him and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth his knife to slay his son. When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, "Lay not thy knife upon the lad, your son. Behold, a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. Offer the ram of pride instead." But the old man would not so, but slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one.
Wow. And your book, Madness at the Gates of the City, is filled with amazing, I mean, history, poetry, quotes, mythology. How long did it take you to write this?
About 9 years. I want to say, though, about that poem, the author was killed in the last week of the war in yet another senseless infantry charge against mass machinery. You know, in that war, 7,000 young men died every single day for 4 years. And I tell this poem because, to me, it speaks, you know, even though it's a fairly modern poem, it relates, of course, to our most, what I would call the most fundamental myth in Western culture, which is Abraham's willingness to kill his son. Whether or not in the original story he killed his son is irrelevant. The point was he was willing to follow his God, the directions of Jehovah, to sacrifice his son. And even if this, and this story itself is probably 3,000 years old. So one of the things it's telling me is that even as far back as 3,000 years ago in Western culture, myth was already breaking down. Because, to speak about initiation, when indigenous people are able to think mythologically and metaphorically and symbolically, and we modern people have pretty much forgotten how to do this. But in initiation, the young men are killed symbolically. It's not the young man. In fact, it's the boy that's killed symbolically so that a man may arise. But what the story of Abraham and Isaac and this modern poem about it is telling us that for a very long time now, Western culture has been taking these myths but unable to see them symbolically and taking them literally. So what Wilfred Owen was telling us in 1918 is that the myth of the rituals and the myths of the killing of the children had been taken literally by Western culture. And you know, something like 160 million people were killed in war during this recent century. And obviously, in this new century, things are certainly not getting any better. So that's really the background to this whole to my quest into looking at American myth. And I think, given how much time we have, I better move on and say a few words about American myth. So. The subtitle of the book is The Myth of American Innocence. So I want to lay that out for you quickly, and then we can get into talking about that. So I want to actually define what I mean by the myth of American innocence. It's a 400-year series of narratives, novels, songs, children's stories, political rhetoric, cartoons, sermons, films, advertisements, etc., that justify American capitalism, racism, imperialism and environmental destruction by blaming its victims and removing all guilt and responsibility from both its perpetrators and its beneficiaries. It is the systematic manufacture of consent based upon terror of the other, which this is what relates us to this mythic image of Dionysus. A terror of the other has been our basic story in American history and culture for 400 years. The primary concepts referred to by our stories are freedom, opportunity, individualism, and competition. We are told that the individual is a blank slate who is free to become anything he wants to be. Paradoxically, this nation of individuals with no inborn purposes is an individual among nations with a divine purpose to bring freedom to the rest of the world. The story is subscribed to in deep unconscious ways by almost all Americans, liberals no less than conservatives. So, and you can see that it's myth when we see it as something that we subscribe to unconsciously without questioning the contradictions. And I need to run back to Joseph Campbell again here to give you a little bit more background. He said there were four basic functions of myth. The deepest is the mystical function, which connects us to the mysteries of the universe. You could call it a spiritual function. Then there's the cosmological function, which explains how the universe came to be. Then you have what he called the pedagogical function, which teaches people how to be a moral person in the culture. And then most importantly, for our purposes, what he called the sociological function, which teaches people how to function within the social structure that they're born into. Now, in indigenous cultures, people were provided with deep, powerful mythic images of kings and queens and divine figures, which represented the essence of who people were, and they represented images that people could aspire to precisely. Mm-hmm. Now, in American culture, this myth of American innocence is pretty much expressing the sociological function. It's pretty much explaining to us and motivating us to tell stories and to perpetually ingest stories that remind us of our innocence, so that we don't have to look at the contradictions in our own history. So often people, when I'm speaking about this part of of my book, people will ask, well, isn't this true about people in general? I don't think so. I think America really is exceptional in this way. No other nation has gone to such lengths to define itself by excluding so many from full membership, including rigid legal systems deliberately intended to divide natural allies, while simultaneously telling itself pervasive stories of freedom and opportunity. See, that's what makes us unique. This is what makes America unique. Perhaps South Africa approached something like this, but it didn't. But even South Africa didn't have these stories of freedom and opportunity. This is a specifically American story. Howard Zinn, for example, said there is no country in world history in which racism has been more important for so long. Only Americans justify invasion and massive violence with stories of idealism and good intentions. The media and every presidential administration since World War II, at least, have, for example, championed human rights and presented America as an ideal for other nations to emulate, while persistently exempting ourselves from the most basic standards of decency. Cornel West says, no other democratic nation revels so blatantly in such self-deceptive innocence, such self-paralyzing reluctance to confront the night side of its own history. So this is what I mean by the myth of American innocence. And there are very unique, specific historical circumstances that led to the formulation of these stories, and I can go into that if you're interested.
And we're going to go to a short musical break. We'll talk about that right after this on KZSU's Lunch Special with Barry Spector, author of Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence.
what you gonna do when the welfare turns its back on you? Now what you gonna do when the welfare turns its back on you? There you'll be standing there stranded. Ain't a thing that you can do. Now you look all through your house. Yes, you can't find a piece of bread, find a piece of bread. Now you look all through your house, my house. Yeah, you can't find a piece of bread. Sometime you begin to wonder if you'd be better off dead.
Was Albert Collins, the great blues guitarist, singing What You Gonna Do When the Welfare Turns Its Back on You. I picked that one because it really does convey some of what we're speaking about here. The notion that even our Democratic president, Clinton, proudly spoke about ending welfare as we know it, remember? African Americans have been the other that white America has distracted itself with for these hundreds of years. But I'd like to say a few words about how we got there, specifically as Americans, and that would mean looking at a very important period of about 20 years in the late 17th century, running from about 1675 to about 1695, where there were four major events that I want to let you know about. One was called King Philip's War. It was in New England. It was pound for pound, it was the worst war we've ever been in. Fully somewhere between 5 and 10% of the New England colonists were killed in this war. So the reason I mention it is because there was an extreme state of paranoia. These were the Puritans of New England who had already brought this paranoid imagination to America. The second thing I want to mention is 1692. That's the Salem witch trials, when this paranoia was focused on one specific spot in New England, and of course it was mostly women who were identified as the witches. The third thing is in Virginia. Around 1680, there was a rebellion. It was called Bacon's Rebellion, in which indentured servants, black and white, united to rebel against the white planter class. This was an extremely violent fight, and when it was over, the planter class realized that they had to create a buffer class of poor whites between them and the blacks. It was only at this point, around 1680, that we began to start speaking in terms of black and white, as a matter of fact. Prior to that, the real distinction in the American South was between property owners and servants. They really didn't distinguish so much. But very quickly, Virginia, and very quickly after that, all of the southern states and or colonies, and most of the northern colonies, instituted laws that specifically raised the status of white people, even if they were dirt poor, and specifically removed certain rights from black people, even if they were free. And the result was that poor whites across the South and eventually across America came to identify as white rather than as poor. And one result of that is as late as current debates among radicals all across the world. People are always asking, why did a strong socialist movement never really arise in America? And the reason is because the white elites have long understood that that it's possible to distract poor and lower middle class white people with the terror of this black other. And the fourth thing that happened, and this is all really important, around 1680, so you had the first publication of what are called captivity narratives, in which a young woman who was captured by the Native Americans and was either ransomed or escaped and came back to white society and told her tales of captivity. Now, as it turns out, for the next 50 years, all but one of the best-selling books in America were captivity narratives. And these stories were repeated hundreds and hundreds and eventually thousands and eventually tens of thousands of times throughout the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. And the basic story is that a young, usually blonde, white woman who symbolizes the innocent society is taken away for no reason whatsoever by these terrible, dark people from outside the pale of the culture. And this story has been our basic American story, just told over and over again, right up into the 21st century, in countless superhero tales and war stories, and you know, just thousands and thousands of Western stories, Star Wars. I mean, all of our so many of our famous movies have the basic tale of the hero rescuing the innocent woman. But here's where I want to get back to the stories very quickly, because I know we only have a few minutes. Again, back to Joseph Campbell speaking about the three-part hero myths. The hero begins in community, he is called forth, and he returns to community with his gift. This story was found everywhere in the world except in America. Of course, the Native Americans had stories like this, but white America told a different story. This hero who comes to save us, he is not part of the community. He comes from outside. He comes and deals quite violently with the black other or the red other, who by the way, eventually morphed into the red communist other. And then what happens is he leaves. He leaves the community. The most classic telling of this story, almost an archetypal telling, is the movie Shane from about 1953,
beautiful.
in which the hero quite literally rides off into the sunset.
Exactly.
Now that is our basic American story, and it's been repeated so many times over, let's say, 20, 25 generations of Americans have been ingesting these stories. So that when we think of masculinity, when we think of femininity, but especially when we think of America as a force in the world, stretching forth our power in places all across the world to bring democracy and to bring freedom, even if we haven't been invited. Just below these are emotions. When we hear these stories, or when we hear the politics, when we talk about the politics, just below this are our mythic tales of this lone hero. And I know we don't have time, but I can tell you there are just dozens of these heroes. And the one thing that they all have in common, none of them are in relationship to a woman.
Amazing. Okay, and we're speaking with Barry Spector, author of Manus at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence, from Regent Press in Berkeley, California. The website there is www.regentpress.net. And to get Barry, please come back to the KZSU Lunch Special. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And for anybody, listeners who would like to get in touch with Barry, his email address is schmoover@comcast.net. It's SHMOOVER@comcast.net. And Barry, please tell us about your website, where you're going to be speaking next.
I have two websites. One for the book in particular, and it has sample chapters and a lot of stuff you can check out for free, and also some other audio. It's www.madnessatthegates.com. I also have another website, www.BarryandMayaSpector.com, which is our portal for poetry and storytelling and much of the ritual work that we also offer to the community.
And you'll be speaking soon.
I'll be speaking. You can catch some of that information on the website. I'll be speaking in two places in Sonoma County next month.
And also, please get in touch with Barry. We'll put all of the links up on an archive of this show, as well as our other KZSU Lunch Special shows on radio4all.net. That's the number 4, radio4all.net. Again, thank you to all our listeners, and thank you so much, Barry, for coming down into the studio, and we're looking forward to talking to you again. And what are we going to leave the folks with as we...
Thanks.
As...
I brought one more music cut for you. This is Jesse Moore, who's a New Orleans musician, who will be in the Bay Area at the end of this month and in September. And in fact, we're going to have a house concert of his music at my house in Menlo Park on September 10th. And this cut is called this was created just after Hurricane Katrina, and it's become kind of an anthem in New Orleans. It's called "You'll Get Through It."
Thank you, Barry. Thank you for listening, and please come back, Barry, again.
You'll get through it. You'll get through it. You're feeling down and out, but don't you ever doubt you'll get through it. You'll get through it. You'll get through it. Feels like you're gonna die, go ahead and cry. You'll get
was dealt you some heavy, heavy blues. You're not the only one, but it's still no fun being you. Open up your heart and let the light in. Healing is just a heartbeat away. You'll get through it. You'll get through it. You're feeling down and out, but don't you ever doubt you'll get through it. You'll get through it. You'll get through it.